This is Jan with Open Source IC Designs.
Thanks a lot. I guess this topic is not a high runner in this setup here, but I expect that the people that showed up actually are interested in the field and will get value for the money. So thanks. My name is Jørgen Jacobsen. I have done IC design for the last 25 years in various companies, two startups and two big corporations. Bluetooth front-end stuff before Bluetooth was actually a thing. Hearing aids stuff, so how to make two hearing aids communicate with each other through a wireless link. And the last 10 years I've been working at a startup where we did the Class D amplifiers, but I will get more into details with that specific. When you talk about IC design, it's all about big volume and very, very big budgets. It's very, very expensive to do. So take a use case where you want to do a 4x4 millimeter microchip. You plan to sell 20 million of these over 6 years. So that's 3 millions a month, a year. And when you convert that into wafers is this big silicium wafer where you grow and produce your things on. You need 33 of them per week. A wafer like this costs $1,000 produced. Then you need to test it. You need to pack it into a plastic package so that you can mount it on a physical PCB. And then you actually are able to sell that in the open market for average $2. So looking in how do I get to this point, because you need to design that chip, you need a design team, you need project management for that, you need to develop a test, you need to do the tape out, you need to buy the masks for that, and you have to pay some tool vendors a lot of money for actually getting into this, and it'll end up in something like $6 million. But with your average sales price here, you actually have a break even within 2 years, and with a total investment of $5 million, you actually have a pretty good revenue and a pretty good bottom line after some years. There's no hockey stick in this. If you see the thing down here, it is a slow ramping thing. It's not like software as a big blockbuster where you suddenly have all the market and you can spin out to the full world. It takes a lot of hard work to do that, but it's pretty good markup in that if you succeed in doing that. So let's try to dive down and have a look at some of the various designs that is here. I took some very, very old things, tried to look at the feature size that you have there. There are probably some 1 micron technology, and that would be 30 years old technologies. These devices are still being sold, and that is probably some of the devices that is pretty hard to get at the moment because of this allocation crisis we have today. These devices are so small, so you can get up to 80,000 devices on a wafer. And when you try to look at the cost of the wafer, then you can see there's a good markup on these devices there. They need to be pretty cheap. They can be pretty cheap in that thing. There's a lot of old hackers around here, so probably some of you will know this microprocessor. It's a 8-bit microprocessor from way back, so that was the thing that came into VIC 16, Commodore 64, stuff like that. It's at that time pretty complex thing to do ICs like that. So that was purely the state of art. But these came in here, and they actually started were able to sell these devices at 1/6 of the normal price for microprocessor at that time, and that opened up the full market for all the home computers and all the hackers that could get started and enter into computing like a lot of us did. So how do we do this? I'll do a brief run through the processes you have to do, and then we'll look at some other devices, and then I'll take you to the open tools and see what's available there to actually produce these IC yourself. So when you do wafers, you do this lithography process where you have your blueprints from your circuit design that you map into these small crystals here, and you dice them up, you put them into a package, and you will see here on the next slide, you actually have a lot of layers that you have built on top of each other. This is again an old process, 180 nanometer technology, 6 metal layers on top of each other. You have the features of having different components here, so you can have various transistors on your base layers, and they changes in the you can have normal bipolar transistors, you can have FETs, they have different breakdown voltages, but that's a library you can choose from when you do that. You also have resistors, but that's basically just like a piece of metal strap there that you extend and route out as a maze. So each time you add another process step here, it adds up to your cost. And for instance, 180 nanometer technology will cost you around $500,000 Danish kroner to do a tape out and get the ability to mass produce that. So not an awful lot of money. So the problem today is that the market is driven very much from the very complex cutting edge feature nodes. So from 40 nanometer and all the way down, where we have our cutting edge microprocessors. So let's have a look at such a device. Probably that one here. This is a 40 nanometer technology tape out. It's the ESP32. I guess you know that one. It's a mixed signal process or IC design. You can pretty easily recognize all the analog stuff that is in the corner. That's the RF stuff. That's where you have all your filters, your oscillators, stuff like that. And then the rest of the IC is just like one big mess of digital logic that they put down there. And you can have pretty a lot in there in a 40 nanometer technology. My best guess is that the tape out cost for such IC like this will be in $5 million US dollar category. So it's a very, very expensive action to go into this area here. But again, Expressive, they sell these devices in lots of millions. So they it works, the economics in this is okay. That was not the one I wanted. I need to go back to this one here. Here. Yeah. So why do we go to the lower feature size? That's of course to gain some speed, because when your transistors get smaller, then your propagation delay through one single gate is very small, and then you can, for a thing like this, get a complex microprocessor up running in the 200 megahertz grade. And of course, we need that. We need to do some number crunching, but we also need some complex, functionality in here, and you have the ability to trade your speed or more complex logic, and this way, obtain the design goals that you have for the given application you're into. So again, we start with sand, we do this wafer, we produce a mask set, and that mask set is actually the blueprint we do when we do the design process. We design the digital stuff, we design all the analog stuff. Then we send that out to a fab in probably Asia somewhere. They start to build the IC based on that. They will etch, they will grow, they will remove, and do one layer at a time. And after 1 month or 2 months, depending on how complex the process is, they will ship you back the IC. Then you will take it to your lab, or you will take it through test, and then you have the IC back again. And that's a long road here. So when you start on this, you need to be pretty damn sure yet you don't screw up anything here. And because you have actually a compile time in 3 months before you get it back and know if you screwed up or that. And that's why you pay a lot of money for the tools, you do a lot of testing before you actually ship out here. So let's try to look into the digital flow. How many of you are actually IC designers? Software designers? Software? Yeah, that's good. And that's the problem. We need more software designers to do ICs. And that's what we are doing when we try to put these tools into the open so that you can start to do ICs. More on that later. So when you want to do a digital design, you take some high-level description language that's either VHDL or Verilog. It describes how your transfer, your registers, and what combinational logic you have between these registers. From there, you get and synthesize a netlist. So that's a fixed netlist of logic cells that are interconnected in a special way. You analyze timing on that. You validate that the functionality that you would like to do is actually what you expect to do. You do that with simulators. Your timing analysis is important here because you know that you have a fixed propagation delay from one register to another one, and you need to obtain your goals before your next flip-flop launches the data there. So you can either fix that by upsizing your devices or do some architectural fix to do that. You need to place and route these cells, this logical netlist you have, into a physical representation. And when you've done that, you have like a square area of a lot of standard cells. These standard cells are AND gates, two input AND gates, five input AND gates, flip-flops, or more complex stuff. You add some spare stuff into that. That's either capacitors or it's lunch breaks, lunch packs, as we call them, because 5 months from now, we find out we need some extra functionality in the middle of the digital core, and then we actually have the ability to use things from the base layer, so that's all the logic cells that we put down there, and then reroute something on the top layers, and then you can get new functionality in what you actually did. Save you from a full mask tape out. The full mask tape out is the 500,000 krona Danish krona stuff. You don't want to spend that again. And also you save a lot of time in doing that. So you need to route the circuit, you route your clock network first, you look at the critical interconnects, and then you test that the network is okay. And then you rerun your timing to see that your interconnect didn't do some shit to your setup here. And then you export it into an analog tool, typically, because you probably will do analog on top when you do a design like this. So there's a lot of people that has been working on these free open source to actually enable this. And there's a setup called OpenLane that actually are able to take your RTL design, take it through synthesis. You use a tool called Yosys, and these tools are typically single man's work that actually are then being gained up and get a lot of attention. If you are designing FPGAs, then there is an opt out from one of the points here, where you actually are able to have open source tool doing FPGAs. And that's because some guys have been doing reverse engineering of how to actually interconnect all the LUTs that you have in these FPGAs and map the logical cells that you actually produce with your synthesis job here. You need to insert some cells that enable you to test the circuit here. You do that by the design for test insertion. And then you are into another flow where you can do a flow plan, you can do your placement of your cells, you do your clock tree synthesis. That's one of the critical things you would like to do. And then you do your routing on top of this. Then you can actually also, with open source tool, do logical equivalent check. So check that the logic that you applied actually are the same after you ran it through this setup here, because you don't really want your, it's all about trusting your tools. Did it do the right thing for me, or was it a mistake in there? Did it will this work when I get it back? So again, more simulation, extract your parasitic things. So what am I coupling between one line to another one? What is my coupling from one line to ground substrate? All here to make sure that you still need the goals of being able to reach your capture to capture from your register, that that's part of this thing still works. Then you do a physical verification check that the design rules that the foundry actually provide you with are correct, and if that's good, you end up with a GDS2 file. And GDS2 file is just like a blueprint that you can ship off to your foundry, and these foundry can make the mask set out of this and start produce your IC. So this was only the the digital part of it. Small slide here, floor planning is where you have all your rows where you put all the standard cells. You plan your IO connection to that, and then you start your routing of that. Here's an example of something that was taped out through a 130 nanometer process. It's a RISC-V processor. They use the open RAM RAM generator. So that's one of the things that is relatively new. University project, open source, you can generate your own RAM. Previously, you have to buy these kind of standard cells from another company that made a lot of money in providing you that kind of memory. You set the width, the depth of it, and you choose the technology, and then they have pre-checked that they are able to generate that. You get a macro box and you put it into your IC. Here, we are now free to do whatever we would like to do in this setup here. This IC here has been taped out through Google and SkyWater's free shuttle run. So it's typically a university or single man person that did this. And my guess is it takes 2 months to do something like this. And if you compare that to what I showed in the first thing, then you are at a fraction of the budget that you have before. And then again, Google is actually sponsoring these shuttle runs, so that's a good opportunity here. Then I'll take you into the analog flow, because the analog flow is a bit more complicated here. Because here you start by constructing your overall system, and in my world, I'm an analog designer, then the digital is just like something we need to interface to the IC, do some logical things, and not much more. The analog is here where you set the performance of the thing, that's where you make sure that your SNR in your audio path is correct. This is where you make sure you don't use too much power, and you lose a lot of trick to do that. But that's all about doing like a block diagram with your bias, your reference generator, your PLL, your LDO, so that you don't get crosstalk from your digital block into your analog blocks. If you do hearing aid stuff or you do audio, then you need to have 110 dB SNR. That's very, very hard to get. Cost a lot of power, and cost a lot of circuits around that to obtain that. You do a lot of trick for that. So when you have identified these small blocks here, you need to design them. You go down to a transistor, capacitor, resistor level. You maybe have some bigger building block. You have diff pairs. You have current mirrors, etc. And you have maybe a bit more complicated op amps. And in that world, there's a lot of not reuse. You do everything from scratch again because you're on a new process. You don't have a big library of these things here, and that's a big hiccup in the analog flow. You simulate the circuit, you simulate it over temperature, over process spread, over voltages, and your analog components that you are offered, they're terrible. They spread with maybe 40%. So you build a lot of them, you slice them up, you do some digital circuit to actually trim these devices so you can actually achieve the functionality and the performance you would like of these analog blocks at a later stage when you get them out and you test them in that way. And simulating on these things on a big ICs projects takes a lot of licenses from these tool providers. Maybe you will have a startup simulation of your circuit. You decide what kind of or what part of your circuit you want to take out, what kind of the digital part, and then you set off a simulation that runs for weeks. And after a week, you have 200 cores being crunching on these things. You get like 50 milliseconds of your startup procedure, and you need to go in and analyze your waveform and see if it still is okay. Terrible process to do. Then when that is okay, you need to lay out the circuit. You need to draw each of these components here. You have some generators that can do your transistors, your capacitors, etc. But you need to interconnect them, and you need to group them logically. And you do this very hierarchical so that you can reuse what you already did. But it's a hopeless process, and you sit in a 2D environment where you see things from upside, and you have maybe 30 layers of different metal layers, VS, you name it, and you don't have auto routers in this this setup. You need to draw a piece of wire, make a via, draw another wire, and after that you need to check that you didn't violate all the rules that the foundry set. So what is the inter-metal spaces that you're allowed to have? You need to evaluate if it actually ruins your circuit. So you do a after layout check again, you extract your circuit and you have a look at it again. So when all that done, you can merge it together with your digital core, you tape it out, and that's the process you enter here. So in the analog world, you have to use a very hierarchical schematic editor, and there are some old tools around. So X-Scheme is at the moment what people use when they do analog stuff in this area here. It's pretty easy to configure so that you get the PDK description of the process from the foundry, what components they offer, and you can put them in your circuit and you can in your tool here, and you can start to design with that. a lot of us use KiCad on a daily basis, and we would love to have that as your main entrance into this world here, but it's not hierarchical in the correct way, so often it unfortunately it cannot be used. When you start to simulate on thing here, you have at the moment two options here. You have Zis. It's a very, very capable large node thing, and you can throw it out on a lot of processors, and it's free. And then you have NGSpice, that is like the daily tool that you will use, where you have some kind of user interface. And that's because what you normally do, you put a netlist into these tools, they do calculation on your specification, and then you get typical a transient simulation of the thing you would like to see, and that's where you go in and see if your voltage levels are correct, your performance of your circuit is correct, but in very small blocks. And you need tools that can scale up and do something on a higher level if you want to do a correct validation of your system. So when you're done the simulation, then you need to draw your circuit, and you have two options here as well. Magic, that is a very, very old tool. I think it's the code base is more than 30 years old, but it's still in active development, and it's, I guess, the best go-to example for what we have right now. K-Layout is an open source tool from Germany. It is very capable, and it has a more slick, more modern interface, and you can actually extend it very easily. You can make device generators and stuff like that. So my guess is that these two tools here will be what you will end up using, and for one thing you use one tool, for the other one you use another one. I'll just take you through a very complex IC here as an example on what you can do. So this is, again, 180 nanometer IC. It's a 3x4 millimeter design. It's a Class D amplifier. It's 2x80 watts into 4 ohms. Pretty powerful. And that's also the reason why that you have a lot of bunt wires out here. And these bunt wires is these very small gold connection from your die to your package. And in this setup here, we have up till 10, 20 amps running in these connections when we drive our speaker. So we need to be able to handle that. You can recognize the square in the middle, that's the digital core. On the bottom area of the digital core, there's level converters, because the digital core run on a much smaller voltage node than the rest of the analog stuff. So there's 200 interconnection between the analog and digital part here. And when I did that, I made a tool, made a web UI, made a database to be able to handle stuff like that. So that's the dealing of doing these kind of complex ICs. Even though you run them on commercial tools, you need to be creative, do something on your own to make the shit happen. Then you have all your loop filters, your household circuit, your thermal protection, and the two rows you have out here is your level converter up for your flying transistors that you have out here. So they are high side devices, and some of them are low side devices. That means that you cannot talk with them directly. You need to level convert something, do a current communication path to them, and complex stuff. We spent 4 years on designing this thing here. It was put to the market 4 or 5 years ago. Soundbox were the first to actually take it into their design. So from Soundbox 2, two of these devices is what drives all the noise that you hear around the area here. And we also were able to sell this to some of the hyperscalers, Sony's and Bausch & Wiggins. So proof of concept, it actually was possible. The complexity of what we did here was actually nominated at the Rock and Roll Festival for IC Designers. And we were there to present that stuff. There's a link for that down there. We take the audience through a very detailed description on how we did it, what kind of technology we have here, and if you want to do something like that, go ahead. It's not easy. So, why is Google entering this here? Google entered this here because they actually need this thing here. So Google came in and they say, okay, so we got the tools. There's tools. We got the IPs. There's a lot of IPs for this. But the PDK, there's no PDK. There's only a PDK if you call up these foundries and sign a NDA with them and get a standard cell kit and all that crap. And it's not for everybody to do. That's big company stuff. So they actually searched around and found another company that was able to do that. So in the PDK, you have the layout rules, you have the layer names, you have all the devices that you do here, and these are distributed in a company industry company standard way with a lot of PDFs. So you need to look through all these PDFs to find some parameters that you need to do when you do the design here. Terrible process. So Google came in here and said, what are you doing? Why is it so hard? Why don't you put all your parameters into a database? Because that's the only way you can actually scale and do more automated processes for what we would like to achieve. So, and Google, they need this. They do a lot of chips for their AI technology. They do it for all their servers. And Moore's Law doesn't help them anymore. We just pack more cores into smaller geometries. We need to do something more. So they say, okay, if we democratize the technology, let it be open, then people from the software background can come in and start to help us to do this. So we just apply the software model we know, where everybody get access to the technology, and then things will happen. And that's why they got this set up with SkyWater. SkyWater is a foundry in US. It's an old Cypress foundry that was considered too old. So the people from the company bought the facility, and they have signed up together with Google and are now running these things here. So what is actually happening? Google is actually offering free shell runs. So with the tools I've designed, I showed you today, you can actually start to do IC design. You need to run it through the company called eFabless. So let's have a look there. I have them open up. I need to put my cursor over here. That's a little bit annoying. So here is the description on how to get started on this. There's a description on how to install the tools, how to get hold of your development kits. Let me see. How to install it. You can run it on your own server, YAML. You can even install it on your laptop, and you'll be able to design things. There's a description of the digital flow that I show you there, and that's what is the most mature thing at the moment. So if you want to start on that, that's a good place to do. So let's have a look at some of the things that have been taped out, because that's the only criteria they do when you sign up and ask for one of these slots here. You need to do an open design. You need to public release the thing afterwards so people can learn from it and they can build on top of what you actually did. So in this setup here, EFabless is the entrance into this, and they have, for instance, let's have a look on MPW1. I think I am in the wrong thing here. Projects. Public projects. So here you see, this is 40 designs that have been taped out start this year using this process here. It's university, it's one man's bands. One guy, he wants to do a full satellite transceiver. He'd done the parts of things, the critical things, and he has a path for the next year where he will do more and more of this design. There's something called the Caravel, and the Caravel is like a system on chip thing where you get an area of the IC in this shuttle run here where you can put your experimentals thing. So you get a microcontroller, you get your logic analyzer, so you can actually connect up to your analog or digital stuff that you did in the IC here. And for that, when you get that IC back, there's a big framework around it, so you don't have to redo everything from this. There's another interesting thing here, where somebody has done some FPGA stuff. Oh my God, that's a lot. So there's now an open FPGA bit cell, and that bit cell is actually one register and some lookup tables. You can configure it from outside, and you can place a lot of them in a row. You can tie them up together, and then there's a full software chain on top of this where you actually can configure your thing here, and you can use all the tools that I showed you earlier in the OpenLane tool flow, and then get started on that. There's a lot of tests for the RAM blocks here as well. So how do we get started in this? Because you still come from a software, you have no idea about digital or analog or stuff like that. So you need to have some help to get started. I need to go back to my presentation here. Next slide. There's a lot of online courses being given out from a company called VLSI System Design. It's run out of India. India are lacking IC designers like hell. So they made a platform where you can actually be on these online courses. It's typically a course that goes from 1 day to 5 days. You can do it in the afternoon or in the evening time. You get assignments, you check them out, and then there's a questionnaire, and you progress from zero to finish in this way. It's a very good setup. I took a couple of them, and they are very affordable. You're talking about $70 for 5 days online training in using these tools. Very, very easy to get started with. And when you take these courses, it's also easy for you to start installing these tools on your own computers. And you have the ability to check out all the design that was done in the shell runs example, and you can see how they're done. And then there's a very, very helpful Slack environment where people show what they have done. And I'll show you another tool, because if you are from the software way of thinking, then you need to have some high-level description languages that can actually make your digital core and the functionality you would like to use there. And there's one guy who's been writing Verilog for many, many years, and he was so tired of it, so he produced a new overlay on that. It's called Transaction Level Verilog. And he built a very, very nice GUI for that, so that you can, in one single web browser, you can get started on this. So I need to take me to this guy here, and we need to open up mega chip here. So, like, take the example from start. Leave. Yeah, I leave. Here. So, it's a setup where you get your IDE. It runs in the browser. It looks terrible, but it works. You can do very, very complex setup in this. And what you will end with is like your digital design files that you will take into the flow that I showed you earlier. So let's start it up here. He creates a sandbox, so here you actually can save your sandbox and then you can get back to it later. It works like you have a simulator on the other side. You can choose your waveforms here, and here you have your system Verilog description down here, and you have your transaction Verilog up here. So he did a lot of shortcuts in the languages here so that you can, from this design, system Verilog that you can take through your design tools. So let's see, there's a lot of examples here. It's very teaching in the way that you, if you go through these examples, and let's try to see what you can find here. There's a lot. CPUs, finite state machines, pipeline FPGA stuff. Let's have a look at the CPUs. We need a pipeline CPU. This is actually a RISC-V processor, so it takes the open source RISC-V instruction set, and we are able to. I press this one here. So what I get now is my editor over here, and you can go through all the code. He has the instruction decoder. He has like the register map. He actually also has some program he can download into memory and see that it works. He has a tagging for pipelining these things so that it's very easy to access something from another stage in the pipeline. And that's the only way you can do this very complex pipeline design. No other languages actually support that. Over here, we have the diagram, and that is a one-to-one map of what you see over here. And there's a simulation thing here where you can look at your waveforms. This is the top level, and I think this one here is all the different stages from the test bench. So he start clocking the processor, load the program, and do what it's told to do. A 1 week course in this tool where you go from knowing nothing about this to implementing your own RISC-V processor using this tool here is a 3 day course. Cost you $70. It's a very, very fast entry path into this world here. Only recommend that. All right. That was what I had. I have some links in the slide deck here that I would like to share with you later. A list of the open source tools that you have. There's a podcast with a lot of interview with all the guys who's been doing designs on the shuttle run here. And the courses from VLSI System Design are linked here. There's a new one starting next week, 3 days from here. So I can only recommend you that you sign up and these try it. Even if you don't participate, you get a good entry in to see what it is. and is a good community. Yeah. And then again, Makerchip, good way to get started on something very simple. There's a good tutorial that'll walk you through this. All right. Questions? Yeah.
About if you were, you're an analog designer, if you make a hardware multiplier, why are those things so big? And are there analog tricks to make it smaller or maybe less accurate and still faster and smaller?
The multipliers is extremely big because you want to do that process very fast. So you can have pipeline designs where you actually program your logic up to do your number of additions all the time, or you can do one that does everything in one go. And that's the reason why they can be very big. That's the one that do it in one go. Or if you do something where you actually have some microcode to run through each step, then they get smaller, but they get slower. And it's all about speed, area, power. Yeah. Yeah.
If you have a mixer, or a mixer, those are much smaller and actually also perform multiplication.
Yeah.
But those are not, cannot be used.
No, no. I don't think there's a way to do that. I've never seen them. All the papers around in the thing would have done that if that was possible. And the thing is that there is a big boundary between analog and digital stuff. And these two group of people, they don't talk to each other in big companies, at least. So when I was doing my hearing aid stuff, we sneaked in the back door and lent the tools from the digital designers to do some FPGA design, etc., because you cannot do analog without digital. It helps when you get to this level here, because then people can see the complexity is not that bad, and you can start to mix these things to get to that point. But yeah, interesting. Yeah.
Regarding the design validation, when you do the validation of the digital part, you do like logic simulation there. But what happens? Could you have a case in which you have signal integrity problems inside of the chip? And if so, how do you actually detect that? Can you simulate it?
Yeah. So if you get a logic cell that is broken in the thing. So you have you have two ways of thing here. So either your design works in your simulator, or you do the fabrication and there's a logic cell where one of the output is stocked at one exactly. Then what you did in one of the steps is that you insert some ability to load up all registers with a given state, and then from there you can clock it into the next state or next flip-flop, and you can scan it out again, and then you need to have like a blueprint of what you expect to have here. So that's the way, because when you test all the ICs in production, you don't want to use it a lot of time for that. So you typically have like 10 seconds to test one single die, like the one I had here, and then you scan in a lot of these scan patterns. You clock the system, you scan them out again, and you compare if you get what you expect. So that's one way to do it. Yeah.
Right, if there's no more questions, then give an applause. Thank you for the talk.
Thanks.